I'm Gene Barry, and I played Clayton Forrester in War of the Worlds.
And I'm Ann Robinson, and I played Sylvia Van Buren in War of the Worlds.
This is the most incredible part of this motion picture, is that George Pal opened it up like a newsreel. No one expected this to be a motion picture. They're talking about World War I, World War II, and all the weapons of mass destruction that took over this whole world. Now we're in World War II, and everyone's expecting, of course, the communists. I love the idea of this newsreel feeling, and suddenly we go into color, and no one was expecting this to be a feature. I want you to listen to this magnificent score, the underscore of this movie. You can just feel the Cold War. You can feel everyone being afraid. George Pal had such an undercurrent in this, the fall and the oppression of Europe, and now our current fears of the Cold War. You know, the 50s spawned all those flying saucers. Good old McCarthy and his communism scared the world half to death, and along comes the War of the Worlds and George Pal, just to finish us off. And I think he did a wonderful job. Very, very convincing film.
When I did the movie, when it was offered to me, I was excited and overwhelmed by it, and it launched me into a very good career. It was my second movie at Paramount. I did one just before it, and
Atomic City. Mm-hmm.
How do you remember that?
Because I love you, dear. I've always loved you. I love the fact that Sir Cedric Hardwicke did this and had that beautiful British influence because of the H.G. Wells book. His voice is so soothing. Love to hear him.
Even at its equator, the inhabitants of this dying planet looked across space with instruments and intelligences of which we have scarcely dreamed, searching for another world which they could migrate. They could not go to Pluto, outermost of all planets, and so cold that its atmosphere lies frozen on its surface.
Chesley Bonestell did all this lovely, lovely artwork that you're looking at. His work still hangs in the Museum of National History in New York. All these lovely planets and all these lovely paintings. Beautiful artwork. I sort of laugh, though. I wonder why they left out Venus. After all, she is the closest planet. We see her first thing in the morning and last thing at night, and yet they left out Venus. Of course, Mars is lovely. We saw Mars this last year. It was 60,000, miles closer, or years, whatever it was, that it's ever going to be in our lifetime. Sort of followed me all around last year, and I was quite pleased. Brought me good luck.
Orson Welles had a big...
You mean the radio show of Orson Welles when he scared America? I have it on record. They re-released a lot of records of that.
Well, it was an overwhelming and frightening experience for most of the people in America. And we discovered it was a broadcast. And eventually I played the role in the movie, yeah.
And possessed a cloudy atmosphere eloquent of fertility. It did not occur to mankind that a swift fate might be hanging over us, or that from the blackness of...
Now, this is going to be interesting. You'll see this lovely star sky, and the meteor will go from the top of the screen to the bottom of the screen, and there, sitting right in the middle of that tree, is little, lovely, adorable Woody Woodpecker. Walter Lance was a very good friend of George Pal, and they were very close in Europe. And so in every movie, he tried to put a Woody Woodpecker somewhere, either in respect or for good luck. This motion picture they're showing, we're standing out in front of Samson and Delilah, which is also a work of Cecil B. DeMille, and a little bit of that religious aspect that George Pal and... always like to put in his movies. And this is something funny, always amused me. That human aspect of someone trying to peek at the cards and just to see what was going to happen, not quite sure what was in the future. It's this ranger that was speaking on his intercom. His name was Robert Rockwell. He was very well liked and very popular, very, very popular. And I think we lost him a few years ago, but a lot of people remember him, and it's so nice to be able to point people out.
Hey, grab this.
Go. Let a hand over.
Number three to D.O. Number three to D.O.
D.O. to number three, come in.
We're getting this under control. We won't need any more.
It's quite interesting, the effect and the influence that Cecil B. DeMille had on this film. He was such a good friend of George Pal's and really convinced Paramount Studio to do this. I don't think Paramount was too happy about it until he talked him into it.
To see it very well. It's too hot. But it's a whale of a size.
Who's that young kid up there?
That good looking one? With the dark hair?
Yeah, that's a me. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's a you.
Ain't you?
Right.
Looks like the fishing was good.
Have some.
Well, I might.
I was born in New York. And I wanted to be in theater. My father wanted me to be an artist. I was also very good at drawing, and he wanted to send me to art school, and I said, no, I want to be an actor. And that's what I did. I just hung in and made the rounds and got a few parts here and there, and it worked. Based upon the fact that I sang, I could get jobs in the summer and work at various summer resorts and that sort of thing. Eventually, I worked in musicals, although I didn't do major singing roles. I did major roles in the musicals. I did little singing. My career was not based on singing. My career was based on acting, performing. I had done several plays on Broadway. I was doing a play with Mae West on Broadway. This young lady came backstage with a friend to visit, say hello to another actor in the show. And the next day I ran into her on 44th Street, and I said, we met last night at the theater. And she said, yes, I know. Betty was her name, and we talked and talked, and I said, how about lunch? You want to go to lunch? And we went to Sardi's, had lunch. Sat there till about 6 o'clock in the evening, and I said, I'm going to Boston for Sammy Kahn and Julie Stein in their first musical, and I'm doing the lead in it. I said, you want to come with me? She said, I'd love to come, but she says, I can't. 3 weeks later, we were married, and we went to Boston together, and we were married for 58 years.
Bring their own lunches. What's the idea, Buck? Going to dig for gold?
You think you're kidding? Going to be like having a gold mine.
George Pal was on the set every single day. I have no idea what he and we used to refer to him as Bunny Haskins. They were very quiet, and I have no idea. I'm sure he had a tremendous influence on this movie. But judging from how long it's lasted, I'm sure it was his hand. He chose Mr. Haskins as a director because he used to be in special effects. He was a director of special effects. So I evidently wanted him in this movie for that particular reason.
Yes, I was fishing up in the hills.
Well, you must have caught plenty with all that tackle.
Well, there were three of us. The others flew back in my plane. I don't understand why a meteor that size didn't make a bigger crater.
Oh, it hit sideways and skidded in. At least that's what I think. I don't really know. But the ranger said a scientist is coming from Pacific Tech. He'll tell us. Clayton Forrester, ever hear of him?
What's that fellow trying to do over there? Dig it out?
Now, this was a dub. You can hear the change in my voice because I had said something incorrectly or it had been incorrectly written for me. Something about top man and astro and nuclear. I don't know if I said physics or fission, but it was an incorrect statement. And you can hear the change in my voice that it was dubbed in later.
They had him on the cover of Time. You know, you've got to rate to get that.
Isn't that good?
Well, now, how can you say that when you don't even know him?
Well, I do know him, slightly.
I had done a small play over at the Circle Theater, which was not too far away from Paramount Studio, and Milt Lewis, who was a talent scout, came over there and asked if I would come over and do a test or read or something. I didn't seem to impress anybody very much, but he kept poking after me. He was sure I had something to offer. And so one time Robert Walker was quite ill, and they were doing some pickup shots on a movie that he had done, and he couldn't make it. He was ill, so they had a standby crew. And they called me immediately, said, get in here and rush me through makeup, rush me through in a wardrobe, and said, do you have anything memorized? And I said, yes, I have a scene from Gaslight, but it needs two people. And they said, well, make a monologue out of it. Now, you can do anything when you're 18, 19 years old. You're not afraid of anything. So I managed to do it and got the contract. And that was in October of 1951. We did our screen test for this movie on December 31st, 1951. We did it on New Year's Eve Day. We tested together. We did two scenes, one the farmhouse scene, and actually the very first scene where we walked together looking at the meteor was one of the scenes. But the better scene of the two was the one in the farmhouse. I don't know what they did to me, but if you'll notice that this Geiger counter really peps up when he aims it towards my left bosom. I have no idea if they put something in my bra or what it is, but my left bosom is certainly radioactive. See? There it goes again.
Oh, I'll post 2 or 3 deputies. They can make sure it doesn't start any more fires, too.
I love the way you did this scene, Gene. Look at that. You're thinking out loud. You're really, you know, inside your own head, and we just happen to be listening to you. Oh, that was brilliant. I did see Lewis Martin several times after that. He was a lovely, lovely man. I'm so glad they chose him to play Uncle Matthew. When I first walked up and tried to introduce you to him, when you look at the movie again, you'll see that I almost forgot his name. I hesitated. Uncle Matthew Collins. I almost made a mistake there. And this is so funny in this scene here. We had to practice and learn how to square dance, but they couldn't find a pair of square dance shoes for me. So they got me a size 10, and they were going to fall off at any minute. And then as we go around in a circle, there's a close-up of my feet, and I just knew those shoes were going to fall off.
Well, let's take another look at it.
This is what I love about George Pal and his nighttime sky. People don't realize, I mean, he understood California night skies and what it looks like here at night with the glow from the city and the fact that in later scenes you'll even see the fog come rolling in off of the ocean. His skies are brilliant, and a lot of people don't notice that. They're so busy looking at actors in the foreground, you don't see what's going on behind you. And here I was working with George Pal, who I grew up with because of his puppetoons. He was such a genius, and he was such a childhood hero of mine, just as Les Tremaine, who we'll see later on, his voice, growing up with that brilliant man, listening to him on radio. So this was quite a treat for me.
Darnest thing I ever saw. The way that's unscrewing.
If you notice, because I was a member of the Golden Circle, we weren't allowed to drink. So it had to be a Coca-Cola in a bottle with a straw. It couldn't be in a glass.
I wasn't a member of the Golden Circle.
No, you weren't.
No.
Mm-mm. You were a contract player.
A contract player, yeah.
You were far more important. The Golden Circle, it started back in 1922 with Gary Cooper. And then they had a second group of people about in the 40s, like Susan Hayward. And then came the third Golden Circle. And Barbara Rush was probably the biggest star that came from that. But it was just Stars of Tomorrow. You know, like I think somebody had Baby Wampus years ago. I've forgotten who started that. And so every studio had their group of hopefuls.
I guess my career ended at Paramount at the end of the second year. It was a 7-year contract, supposedly. I didn't go 7 years. I finished 2 years, and after War of the Worlds, I was surprised which was done in my second year, they terminated the contract, and I got a contract at another studio. I think the industry was going through a very difficult period at that time.
The TV was popping up.
And TV.
Yeah, television.
That's what was happening.
And commercials on television were popping up and taking jobs away from us.
Yeah. But I went on, and I had a very good career thereafter.
I don't think you did badly at all, Toots. I think you did a darn swell job. You've never been without a job. You've always been working, and you had that magnificent voice. You did commercials.
Yes, I did, 12, 13 years of commercials.
I left before this picture was even released.
Really?
Why, Frank Freeman Jr. was a co-producer with George Pell. And he said, by God, you can't let this girl go where the movie hasn't even been released yet.
Yeah.
After it came out and they needed publicity, now they have to hire me back to travel all over the country while this is being released.
At that time?
In August of 1953. Went back to New York City where it opened at the Mayfair Theater in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
Stood there on the little island and took a picture of it. And I still have that picture 50 years later, the day it opened.
Hey there! Open up!
How are they going to understand us?
We're talking sign language.
They'll understand us all right.
Sure?
Sure? Everybody understands when you wave the white flag, you want to be friends? Hey there! Open up!
Come on out! We're friends!
That's right! We welcome you! We're friends! Yeah!
Any candles around?
Hey, look! Look! All the lights in the town have gone out.
Somebody's found some candles.
Johnny, Zippy, I like it in the dark.
Call the electric company and see what happens.
Okay.
The machine we had in when the day the Earth stood still seemed to be, it was a friendly flying saucer because the man came to Earth to look after us and take care of us and tell us to behave ourselves and stop behaving like such twits and fools, where these people weren't coming to do anything but to harm us. And it was a perfect thing because nothing looks more frightening in the ocean as this quiet, floating, beautiful stingray. And then, of course, who likes the looks of a cobra with a full hooded head staring at you? Explanation for a thing like this. Do you have a pin? I came on the set one day and they had this cobra head before they put it in the meteor. It was enormous. I'd swear it had to be at least 15 feet or more, 20 feet tall. And I walked up to it and I said, "What is this?" Somebody flipped the switch. The light ray came on, not the one that disintegrates you, just the light came on, and this horrible noise came out of it. Swear to God, I must have jumped 5 feet off the ground. They had a very good laugh, but it was very realistic in person. We were very naive people in those days, very, very
innocent and perhaps not very imaginative. We didn't think that all this mysterious stuff's going on. Because I always sort of was convinced that flying saucers were here to stay.
Let's go see.
Power lines are down. That explains why the lights went out.
What? Hey, look at the cars.
Where are the three men you left out here?
Look there.
People in town started to follow us. Don't let them come anywhere near here.
I think Linda Rosa, I think we're supposed to be somewhere around, we're in Orange County somewhere. It's a fictitious town, because later on we do say we walked halfway from Corona, but that is where the plane went down. And I was in Corona not too long ago, and I was amazed. The farmland is still there. It is not, in some places, in some areas, it's not that overcrowded. You still have a lot of farmland. You could probably still film in some areas. You could film there.
Get moving on the double.
Take cover along the riverbed. Get those 30.
A lot of the scenes you see with the Army, most of it is with the Arizona National Guard. They did a lot of location shots in Arizona. That's where we went first. And later on, you'll see us running through muddy, muddy terrain.
Not in Canada yet, but in Bordeaux, France, some in Spain. There's supposed to be one down near the Gulf of Toronto, Italy. We're trying to locate the second meteor that landed in this vicinity just about midnight.
Well, do you think they come from Mars?
What do you think, Dr. Forrester?
Oh, it's possible. At least it seems certain they're from some planet other than our own.
Suppose they are Martians, Professor.
Oh, you have to look at these two men. One is George Pell, and the other one is Y. Frank Freeman, Jr. And all these scenes you see are taken, really, from When Worlds Collide. As you're panning across here, you'll see that blonde standing in the doorway. It's Carolyn Jones. I have no idea what her scene was and why they cut it out.
Smell colors. Precedent in our own evolution makes it possible that they have more than one brain.
You mean two? Three? Just think of that, folks.
It's only speculation.
And now, Dr. Forrester, what about these meteor machines?
They're probably controlled by jets after they enter our atmosphere and navigated by some form of gyroscopic mechanism.
Thank you, Dr. Forrester. Oh, Colonel, can you tell us anything about this plane that's coming over?
It'll drop a flare. That's the only way we dare put a light on them. Then Air Force cameramen will get...
Now, a lot of people make a mistake of thinking that this is Paul Frees. This is not. Paul Frees comes in much later. Of course, it's quite distinctive. You can tell the difference between the two voices. I made the same mistake earlier.
Is that the plane now?
That's his signal.
The pilot has just flipped his motor. That means he's dropped the flare. He's flying high, so it'll take a few seconds for it to come down. When it does burst, we shall be the first men on Earth to get a real look at these invaders from space.
Now, you have to live in Southern California to appreciate a night sky. We are unique.
They're after the plane with their rays.
Hey! They cut me off! They got my truck!
It looks like they're gonna come out of that gully pretty soon. We'll have to rush our defenses to be ready when they do.
We're going to need plenty of reinforcements.
We'll get them.
With the large tanks, though, this is probably Arizona National Guard. We're there a day or two. I love my Red Cross armband. It's left over from World War II. I still have at home a sign that says fallout shelter, or somebody who was a next-door neighbor had a sign where they were the head person, for the block to take care of you in World War II. Of course, I collect all the memorabilia I could get my hands on because it's terribly important. But I wondered how they built this bunker so quickly. I guess the CBs were there.
Keep your ready to pull you out fast. But you'll get first crack at them.
Suits me. Will that be
Colonel Hefner?
Yes, report when you're set up. Hefner. Fast tracks?
Okay. Get in back of Hill 3. Repeat. Hill 3. If it's a moving target, follow up from there.
Number 7.
Right.
You hear me?
Anybody get a look at the Martians yet?
They've located that second meeting.
Report to range.
Mark it up.
Weapons truck turned over on the road. Take action and report. Company tactical net out of action. No radio.
Range. 1-8-0.
There's one. There's the other. Here we are right between them.
So is the town, I notice.
I warned them to be ready if they have to evacuate.
I just came to tell you. Everyone has been alerted.
As you were. General Mann, I was told to expect you, sir. I'm Colonel Hefner.
I'm here to make up a report. Not to interfere with the operations you've set up. You're still in command. Clayton Forrester. I haven't seen you since...
Oh, Lester Mayne is something else, that man. Something else. Lester Mayne and our president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in 1942, had the most recognizable voices in the country.
You've certainly got them surrounded. I suppose they've neutralized...
He came out of radio. He
Oh, yes.
He was the biggest...
He did over 30,000 radio shows.
Yeah.
I listened to him as a child on Little Theater off Times Square. I loved him. I grew up listening to Lester Mayne's magnificent voice, Mr. First Nighter, and he dressed in full dress when he did that on radio, top hat and tails.
I was always impressed with his ability and his onstage presence.
Growing up with him on radio, I used to listen to him on Orphan Annie, Jack Armstrong, all my favorite programs in the afternoon. And we would sit down and he would tell me what show he was on and I would guess what the sponsor was. And he was just a charming, charming man. I was so thrilled to get to meet him after all those years, listening to him night after night, or at least once a week.
By ray of undetermined nature. Local reports say nothing remains. Nothing remains. What do you make of that?
All we've seen is the heat ray they use.
Well, some of our newest weapons are in here. We want to be sure to stop them.
We will, sir.
That was quite an evening, that 50th reunion, which I'm going to have to brag about that I put together. I got everybody that came was in that theater. I begged and pleaded and borrowed, and that was one wonderful night.
with a beautiful brand new print that Paramount and John Hirschker was so kind to have struck for us. And Les Tremaine stood up, and he'd had seven strokes. He was 90 years old. He had not been well. His darling wife, Joan, wasn't sure that he was going to make it. But he got up and he walked on his own. When he heard the applause, it was like, you know, like that fire horse they say rings the bell, and up he got and he walked, he spoke, and he looked at himself and he felt like his old self again. It was a shot in the arm. And dear sweet man, he passed away then. We lost him in, between New Year's and Christmas, we lost him. He and his wife were both very, very ill, and she barely recovered, and he didn't. But now she has the tape. And she called me right after he passed away, and she said, oh, thank God, I have this tape. I think this is a portion in the movie where the Martian war machines lift out of the gully. Nobody knew, but they had 1 million volts of electricity all over Stage 18. Now, if you look, you can see the sparkling. You can see the electricity coming down from the tri-legs. So after that, you will see just the ground being stirred up with smoke and flames. But meanwhile, this image is now imprinted in your brain, and you never forget it. You think you see it all the time, and you only see it twice.
Is that some kind of a flying machine?
No.
Gene, this is everybody's favorite line of yours.
This is amazing.
Here you're a scientist, and it's the wonderment and glee and joy as if you were a little boy. You are just looking at something so exciting, something you've never seen before, and that thrill in your voice saying, this is amazing. Everybody loves that line.
But Colonel, shooting's no good.
It's always been a good...
We weren't there. At least I wasn't. Maybe Anne was.
Of course I was.
You were there watching, making the special effect?
I watched everything.
Well, I was probably off working somewhere.
You were probably off working, and I had time on my hands. You see what happens when you have nothing to do? That's why I remember everything.
Yeah.
Well, it was Stage 18. Everything was done on Stage 18, their largest stage.
I was, you know, by the time this was released, I was already, probably had done two other movies.
Target is indicated.
Look at her, isn't she?
Aren't I sweet?
Lovely, ma'am.
Oh, and if you look at that little ring on my finger, I have it on today, the same ring. A little diamond ring that my daddy gave me on my 18th birthday, and I... Just a little piece of memorabilia there. I brought it along with me today for good luck.
Dr. Forrester says there's some kind of advanced civilization.
And that isn't my hair. That's a dreadful wig. They were afraid my own hair, short and red, would date the picture. So they put this god-awful wig on me. And it's in two pieces. The bangs and the back of the hair are two separate pieces. And even 25 years later, George Pell said he was sorry he didn't leave my hair alone.
How old are you then?
Oh, probably 19, I think. I was 20 when it came out. So that lets you know, 50 years ago, last year, I was 70. And what a wonderful face this man has. This was on Stage 18, and these gigantic machines, what a thrill it was to walk in there and see these three. At that time, of course, there was no sound effects. So you saw these three huge machines flying silently across stage 18, being controlled by these separate levers. I do believe there were 14 or 15 wires. 14 were electric and 15 were guide. They were amazing, amazing. I thought they were even more ominous when they floated silently.
And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Now, this was a brilliant piece of direction. The director, darling Byron Haskins, said, when the red light hits your face, scream. Because I'm not looking at anything. I had to do it twice because the sound man wasn't expecting me to scream that loudly the first time. They didn't know I had it in me, and I don't think I did either. I just opened up my mouth and out she came.
Those shells can't get through to them. They put out some sort of electromagnetic covering, a protective blister.
It's brilliant that it isn't Technicolor because it'll never fade. It'll always be rich and beautiful like you see. The cameras were enormous, and you had to pad them and cover them up because they were so noisy. Now you have three films running through that simultaneously. That's why they referred to it as three-strip Technicolor. And so the process was enormous. The lights were very, very warm. Extremely warm. And that's what's so amazing. I suppose that it's all done by filters, too, because the lights had to be so bright for the three-strip Technicolor, and yet it had to look like night. It had to look dark.
That skeleton beam must be what they used to wipe out the French city.
It neutralizes Maison somehow. They're the atomic glue holding matter together. Cut across their lines of magnetic force and any object will simply cease to exist. Take my word for it, General. This type of defense is useless against that kind of power. You'd better let Washington know. Fast!
Hold him as long as you can.
Right, sir.
What is so lovely that George Pal told me that if you notice all the bad guys are coming from the right and all the good guys are coming from the left.
Everything, pull back north of Highway 6 and Tunnel Bunker.
Right!
Everybody out! The Air Force will take care of these babies now. Dr. Forrester, get out of here! Everybody out of here!
We were all fireproofed. We had fireproofing all over us.
Really?
Just in case, because the flames were right above our heads. Now, we're in Arizona here. We'd just run from the bunker. The bunker had exploded, and suddenly I have a mysterious purse hanging from my arm. I have no idea where that came from, except, as I said, it was one of the very first scenes we had filmed, so the woman from the wardrobe department said, handed me a purse and stuck it on me, and away I went. So you never see it again. You never saw it before. Where it came from, 'tis a mystery. How lovely they'd established in the very beginning of the movie that Clayton Forrester could fly a plane. There's somebody just yanking the tail of that plane around. And look at that lovely miniature. Bob Burns has that miniature. It was used over at the Egyptian Theater.
All about the Martian invasion. They're in New York and Miami, fighting outside Los Angeles. All about it.
This was funny when Les Tremaine told me when they had this scene and they came driving up to City Hall, there was some army chaps walking down the street and they didn't realize he wasn't a real general. And they snapped to and saluted him. And he said he didn't know what to do, so he had to salute him back. He didn't, not going to stop for a minute, you know, and explain it to him.
Guns and equipment going out there all night.
Come on, break it up.
The way he's hedging, maybe the army didn't hold him. I've seen news off the Pacific cables. Sydney, Australia, Penang, Rangoon, India. From what's coming through, nobody stopped him yet.
I want to know. If the city must be evacuated,
we're ready. Lots of people have already moved out.
We mobilized emergency cars and buses.
We are now 50-some-odd years beyond making this movie. And I'm looking at it now, and I see these faces, these actors. And it's like it was yesterday. It's strange. Do you feel that same way?
I don't recognize myself anymore. The other actors,
the other
absolutely.
Actors, I look at them and I. And I see them and it's like it was yesterday, exactly. And that was 50-some-odd years now. They're all old guys today if they're still around. Yeah.
But we're still hanging in there, Toots.
Without the heavy screening we use. That's where they get the power for their rays. Very well, sir. Call Victorville. Tell them I want the fastest plane they've got. You'll get all further instructions from 6th Army Command. Now I'll make a statement to those reporters.
All right.
We also were about 2 weeks into shooting before we realized we didn't have the rights to shoot it in sound. We couldn't shoot it in talkies. It was... No talkies were allowed, and I have no idea, but everybody was, I don't know if we stopped shooting or not. I don't recall. I do recall there was a bit of a furor. Something had gone wrong, and they had to correct it immediately. It's so funny, everybody always thought there was a romantic interest between Clayton and Sylvia, and there wasn't. The poor fellow was stuck with me. You know, they blow up my city, they kill my uncle, they burn everybody up, we run for our lives, we crash in a plane, and he just dragging me along with him, trying to protect me. There wasn't any. But no, there was affection. I'd written my thesis about you, so therefore I had a crush on you. I think you'll notice in the close-up here, I was trying to look glamorous, and so I had my makeup man put some false eyelashes on me. And then when they had the rushes, I thought the front office would have a fit because I was now looking a little too glamorous. When I open up my eyes, I'm fluttering these long, lovely lashes. There's an edit here, because something about your tie reminds me of my uncle, and there was conversation, and they cut that out. There are about only two edits that I recall in this movie, and this was one of them. I cooked these eggs, I'll have you know. I cracked them, and I cooked them. I basted them. And then when I had to serve them the first time, they fell right off the spatula, too much bacon grease. I love the fact that we're so cleaned up. I love Hollywood.
I get my meals in coffee shops and restaurants.
Don't you live at home?
No, on the campus.
Now, this scene was our test scene. Do you remember? This is the scene we shot for our test. See how we look together. And I think we look pretty snappy.
I have no close folks.
Who's that young boy?
Same good-looking fella that I'm sitting next to right now.
Yeah, I'll tell him.
Let him know when you see him.
We'll get out of here safely. Don't worry.
But they seem to murder everything that moves.
Other than the fact that it was so calm and relaxing. I felt so comfortable because it had been the screen test. And so all the hysteria and nervousness of a screen test had now disappeared, and we'd settled in. Of course, we're now more accustomed to one another. A lot had been going on. And so I do think this is probably the nicest scene in the film. I think both of us are very believable. It's just a lovely, I think it's a very lovely scene.
I stayed right by that door, praying for the one who loved me best to come and find me. It was Uncle Matthew who found me.
I liked him.
He liked you. Oh, I could bow my head off.
50 years ago, to use the expression, I bawled my head off, nowadays has a totally different meaning. If he could only have said, I cried my eyes out. Every time we're in a theater and they come to this line, people just fall over backwards. They hoot and holler, stamp their feet and applaud. Poor little Sylvia, out there in the wilderness bawling her head off. Somebody will just pull this table right out of the way. And then when the Martian puts his hand on my shoulder and Gene throws an axe at him, suddenly this poor guy is yanked right out of the scene. He almost fell off the dolly. When you spoke, it was like you were thinking out loud. Everything was just so quietly spoken.
Well, that's part of my stage training. You know, you make it happen. You're just not doing words, you know.
At the very beginning, when you're talking about the meteor and how it must have come in and this way and gone that way, you're analyzing and thinking, but you're speaking out loud. You're not saying lines. And that's what was so brilliant about it. It was so quietly done.
When you play the scene, it's all in there, you know, but you're playing the moment. You play it for now. Who are you? Where are you going? What the effects are on you, around you, creating your reactions? What is your purpose? You know, you work this out in your head.
Actually, this film was started in the regular old format of the square screen. And then someone else, I don't know, 20th Century Fox, someone came out with widescreen. And suddenly, we were now passé. When they went to CinemaScope and had to put on a lens that elongated the film, suddenly you could see the top of some of the sound stages. And I think in one of these scenes, you can see the catwalks. No one noticed it. It's just very much like when the war machines first came out of the gully, you see all the guide wires. Before they put the large lens on, you didn't see them. But now, of course, the guide wires, they're very endeared. Everybody finds them very sentimental and loving. I grew up listening to a radio show on Saturday morning called Let's Pretend. And it influenced me because I said, oh, Let's Pretend is what it's all about. As long as you're not afraid to make a fool of yourself and you just pretend. We're not looking at anything. And we can't see what ends up on this screen. We are pretending what we're looking at. I love the way you think you are seeing electricity, but you still hear the sparks, which is lovely. They still have the sparks in there, and the ground is burning, and smoke is coming up.
It's pulling out.
Now, this, I remember they had to stop and cut because as it came to the window, it's on two guide wires. So now they stop and cut and bring it through the window and continue the scene.
Can't we get out of here?
And I always loved my slip was showing. But my seams were straight. If you notice this Martian, they had to make two of them because the original one was entirely too big. So poor Gamora and his daughter worked all night long to make the smaller version, but they didn't have time to make the arms, so these arms were not meant for this body. And they wanted to cover it in liver, but the studio said it's bad enough looking. We don't need liver. And it was so wet and so shiny that they thought it was going to rip when they put it over.
You talking about your dress?
No, I'm talking about the Martian, Willie Lump Lump, as he was so affectionately known as.
Stay way up to the attic.
This, you know, has been one of the most influential movies of its time. As I said, I had a friend of mine, a chap I met by the name of Don Watts, who completely gave up his career to go into mathematics, wrote an entire book on nothing but mathematics. There's not a written word in it. I love when shadows come in. That's always so mysterious. Now, this poor guy's being rolled in on a dolly, if you know it. It's like a skateboard. Poor little Gamora's inside this thing.
Was he? A little guy?
Yes, he's a small little fellow, Charlie Gamora. He can't see anything. You watch this one shot. It's all done in one shot. And I could not feel that hand on my shoulder. They had to cue me when it was going to happen. And somebody had to be underneath him placing his arm on my shoulder. So this is all done in one take, one shot, except for this cut. Now, Gene throws an axe at probably the only kind Martian in the whole movie. And then they decide to destroy the world. It's all Gene's fault. Dr. Forrester just ruined everything.
Scarf.
It's wet.
Blood.
So many people get so sick and tired that I scream one more time. They say, will this girl ever be quiet? Now, some people think that I get slapped here. I don't recall that. At first I thought I did, but in the preview, he says, we'll get out of this somehow. The audience fell out of their seats laughing. And so wherever that line came, this is the other cut that I was aware of, the one sleeping in the ditch and this one. And as so many people think that perhaps this is the moment that we fall in love and he's going to kiss me and take care of me, we're not in love. That's a blue screen. I remember the first time I'd ever seen a blue screen. But no, we're not in love. He just was taken, looking after me, stuck with me and taking care of me.
Depths of space, they are war machines, awesome in their power and complexity, created a wave of fear which swept into all corners of the world. In every country, government officials met in desperate conclave, seeking ways to coordinate their defenses with those of other nations. The government of India, driven from New Delhi, met in a railroad coach, while massive Hindu populations streamed for the imagined safety of the faraway Himalayas. The redoubtable Finnish and Turkish armies, Chinese battalions and Bolivians worked and fought furiously. Every effort against the tremendous power of their otherworld antagonists ended in the same frantic rout.
It is interesting. Yeah, all the stock footage, it's just made this film brilliant where they needed it. All the Hindus making their pilgrimage. That's why they were all dressed in white. All the exodus of all these people, all the humanity, all the... Of course, the stock footage is pilgrimage, but it looks as if they're running, they're horrified. I love all the buildings falling. This came from a terrible earthquake that had been filmed. And also you see it in When Worlds Collide. A lot of the stock footage it's repeated now. You saw it originally then. You do see one building, curiously enough, the same building collapses three times. And from what I understand, that was because of Vesuvius erupting in the 30s. It was caused by the lava flow.
Of the British Isles. The people of Britain met the invaders magnificently, but it was unavailing. As the Martians swept northward toward London, the British cabinet stayed in session, coordinating every item of information that could be gathered, passing it on to the United Nations in New York. From there,
it was brilliant. You know, jets were so new to us in 1952.
Strategic point.
48 north, 2 west, 31 east. Anchored on Cairo.
Checking. Dover blanked out.
Brazil checking.
Major Bentley Dawson.
This was most amusing. I wish I'd had the original. War machines that they used in this scene. They were just miniature little war machines and on a tripod, and they pushed them around. And I said by lunchtime they had all been stolen. And Mr. Forrest A. Ackerman, I think, had the only last remaining, and I hope he still has it.
They form a crescent. They anchor it at one end, sweep on until they've cleared a quadrant. Then they anchor the opposite end in reverse direction. They slash across country like scythes, wiping out everything that's trying to get away from them.
That explains why communication is cut the moment their machines begin moving.
Montreal's blacked out. Nothing more has come through.
Same thing that happened on the Pacific coast. Anything from them yet?
No, Mr. Secretary. We've had nothing from San Francisco for over 5 hours.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Here's that Los Angeles picture, sir.
They released it very big in New York City. It was in August of 53 at the Mayfair Theater, and it was big.
I remember that.
But out here on Hollywood Boulevard, it appeared very quietly at the Apollo Theater. Very quietly, on November the 25th, 1953. They just sort of sneaked it here. We had a sneak preview over at the Fairfax Theater, where they did a little editing to see how the audience reaction was. But they didn't have any big fanfare here. The only public reaction I remember was after the sneak preview, how very silent the people were, how very introspective they were. They were thinking. They weren't expecting this. They were, as I said in the beginning, they were expecting, it started out like a newsreel. They were not expecting that we were going to be invaded by Mars. And it seems so logical that it could happen this way. That's the Writers Building at Paramount Studio, and it's still there.
Forrester, everybody's been looking for you.
I know. We walked halfway from Corona. Finally found an abandoned truck. This is Mrs. Van Buren, Dr. Gratzman, Dr. Pryor, James, Bilderbeck. What's this I hear about the A-bomb?
We've been assigned a special detail. We're going in right afterwards to study its effect.
We're leaving in half an hour. What's that?
King-sized fisheye?
This is an electronic eye. The Martians modeled it after their own eye. They use it the way we use a periscope.
It'll tell us a lot about their metals and alloys.
If this is actually a lens, we can find out about their optics.
Interesting. Very interesting.
And this? The blood of a Martian.
At first, the thought of doing a science fiction movie did not excite me. Because I wanted a drama, you know. Didn't want to have to deal with special effects and all that sort of thing. But then when I got involved in it, it became one of the most important things I ever did.
And it was drama.
The picture is based upon the physical things that happen, aren't they?
I have, absolutely.
Add the clouds and dust, it amounts to no more than our twilight.
Now, if you'll step over here, please. We've rigged the epidioscope to reflect whatever the Martian lens picks up.
There it is, the mic shadow. I see the boom, too.
How the Martians see us.
I think what you see on the screen itself was a pickup shot that was done a few weeks after production had finished. Or they just didn't have time to do it then, and it was easier for them to do it at post-production.
Let's see why they were so curious about you, Miss Van Buren.
I love this fishbowl. This gets a lot of laughs.
I'm good started, gentlemen.
Those snickers.
That Martian blood. Let them make a quick analysis of it to see what we've got.
It might give us something.
Something we could use.
Oh, let it go. If you're interested in Martian blood, you get all you want right after the plane drops the bomb. Flying wing is going to carry it.
This flying wing was the most incredible plane that ever was built.
Hello, Tower. This is Airport.
And to this day, the stealth has not broken one record that this airplane has set. There was some senator who wanted them to change it, I don't know, from Lockheed to Northrop or Northrop to Lockheed, I'm not sure. But because they wouldn't change it, he had it destroyed. Very poor sport. And a little of John Provost, who did Lassie. His father actually worked on the flying wing. I saw it twice in my life, flying over very quietly, very silently, very high. Got to see it. Now, this is Paul Fries.
The guy that's speaking is Fries.
Yes. I made a mistake, too, along with a lot of people. He was not in the first segment. He did so many things for Disney and everybody else.
I don't mind watching dailies. As a matter of fact, if I have any problems with the scene, I would like to go in and see what happens if we get out of the problem. So, but they didn't always give you that opportunity. I remember when we shot this in the Hollywood Hills.
Yes, I have photographs of it, stills. So when I went in to see the first dailies, I saw how flat-chested I was, and they put falsies in me. I was so thin. They said, this girl has no sex appeal whatsoever. There were only 50 people there, and George superimposed 50 people to look like they went all the way. They were supposed to be the San Gabriel Mountains, but we're not. We're just walked up past the observatory, and we're up in the Hollywood Hills.
Bombing plane that's coming over. All radio is dead, which means that these tape recordings I'm making are for the sake of future history, if any.
Future history, you said.
Yes, if any.
Bildebeck has calculated how long we have got until Martians take over the entire world.
If the A-bomb fails, that is.
Here comes the other winner. Listen to this.
The same number of days it took to create it.
I have never heard anything so pathetic in my life. I've often wondered how Betty Davis would have said that.
2 minutes to bomb time. Prepare to take shelter. If you have no goggles, turn away. Remember, the heat flash and concussion that follow are dangerous.
I think it's a remarkable movie. I really do. and I think it's going to stay for a long, long time. When you look at it today, it's 50-some-odd years old, and it works. Seeing it again today, it doubles that reaction. And I think it's going to be here forever, or as long as there's the movie business.
He's out of the plane, sir.
Right.
30 seconds.
Look.
And we're so close to the bomb site, the drop. I mean, nobody knew in those days, even during the testing of a real atomic bomb out in the desert, all those poor people were too close. And look how close we are. And the people that are out there, very right next to the drop. They had about 3 or 4 huge airplane propellers on us. And then they kept throwing all this dirt and Fuller's earth and everything they had all over us. I almost blew my wig off. Thank you, Gene, for holding on to my wig as tightly as you did. That would have been rather embarrassing, snatching me bald head. Isn't that mushroom cloud and fabulous? It was huge.
There's something moving.
I spoke to a scientist over at Caltech who had discovered a particle of the atom, and he said he loves the fact that we dropped the atomic bomb and nothing happened. He said, I love this movie and that one particular scene. We did it. We dropped the bomb, didn't make a dent.
Washington issued orders. In event the A-bomb failed, evacuate all cities in danger of attack. They'll be moving on Los Angeles now.
Prior to this scene, George Pal wanted to, when the actors put their goggles on, he wanted everybody in the audience to have 3D glasses because he was going to shoot the rest of this film in 3D. And Paramount absolutely objected to it. And then a few years later, they come out with that awful Buona Devil in 3D. That would have been a fabulous addition to this movie to have had it ended in 3D.
There is a chance.
We may get a lead from that anemic blood.
You mean by some biological approach?
We know now that we can't beat their machines. We've got to beat them.
This freeway hadn't even been opened yet. This is downtown L.A. They hadn't even opened it yet.
Are coming this way. We must evacuate the city. Take food and water and extra clothing with you. All major highways have been marked to lead you to shelter and welfare centers in the hills.
Well, you see a scene here where Cahuenga Pass, standing on Barham Boulevard. It happened to rain that day, so we had a lot of traffic because of the rain. So they grabbed a tripod, ran out and shot it. George Pal, I grew up with the Puppetoons. He was a hero of mine. And Lester Maine, there's General Hospital. But in all the wonderful sights and sounds around L.A.
Did you grow up here in Los Angeles, you think?
Yes, I was born here. Hollywood Hospital. And this is on the opening credits of General Hospital. Every day you see this shot.
Thank you.
warning!
No!
This is on the back lot. They had a stunt girl ready to drive the bus for me. I didn't really know how to drive this bus, so I put it like in second gear and revved the motor and let the clutch out very slowly because I didn't know how to drive it. I just drove it. So that's when I got the close-up driving. Oh, and that dear man you see, doctor, who plays Dr. Pryor, is Robert Cornthwaite. He also played in The Thing, except they had to put a beard on him then to make him look like a very old man. But he was a very young man in this movie, and he's such a delightful man. I'm sure you'll all recognize him.
Gosh.
Oh, Gene, I just thought it was brilliant the way you just stood there and everything was so quiet. And it reminded me of everything was, it was so ominous. Everything was over with. It was very much like that wonderful movie On the Beach. This is Ethan Hill, Sunday morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning. And to think that we had to dirty it up for the film. Now, it just looks like that anyway.
Hurry up. Get off, Buster. I'll give you $500 for the place. I'll make it $1,000.
Money's no good anymore, Mac.
Here comes another truck.
Pull that guy up.
This is a wonderful shot.
Look at that.
I know. Look at them.
They pull me out of there.
Absolutely.
Mm.
It looks just like the truck's going to run right over you. There goes Morris.
Good here now.
The thieves, robbers, worse. They wouldn't leave with the rest.
It's like this all over.
They've got to be stopped. Those instruments.
Hold it a minute. We've got to have those instruments. They're our only chance.
Did that mob grab the trucks ahead of me? There were a lot of Pacific Tech people with those.
That character actor you're seeing now is Ned Glass. You've probably seen him in West Side Story, in Bad and the Beautiful, many, many shows, many movies. I think that's the old May Company building. It was right around there on 8th and Hill. Do you remember doing that? Must have been some experience to see that all empty.
Who's that nice looking young guy there?
That's that dear twin brother. That's Dorian Gray, sweetheart. You got him in the closet.
I got it.
I think this is the prelude to the time machine.
Rutschman! Bilderbeck!
This is incredible. These miniatures, you know, they're about waist high. And when you look at the size of City Hall, it was about 12 feet tall.
left around here.
And I'm wondering why they're advertising Kimball and Sons Mortuary, because there actually was one.
Paul, they cut their own throats!
Nuts, come on, jump in.
And there's the Herald Examiner building.
Hurry up, jump in!
There was a girl with them, if I could find them.
Come on, jump in, will you?
Kind of lost. You look kind of lost yourself. I think I know where she'll be.
Come on, come on. It's your last chance to get out of here.
I'm looking for you, right?
I'm behind the door in the church, waiting for Uncle Matthew. But my knight in shining armor comes instead. There's the church that's on Franklin Highland, the Presbyterian church. Now these doors are on the back lot.
We humbly beseech thy divine guidance, O Lord. Deliver us from the fear which has come upon us, from the evil that grows ever nearer.
I'm looking for Nancy Hale. There she is, little Nancy Hale. She was one of the Golden Circle girls. They would put them in here and there.
O Lord, we pray thee, grant us the miracle of thy...
This was the first scene we shot, except for the one on location. They didn't have that many churches on the back lot, so they will redress this church several times, adding pillars, adding stained glass windows, candles. So, because he does have to go through several churches searching for Sylvia.
It's an amazing thing for me to watch it under these circumstances.
Analyzing
it. Scene to scene, yeah. The picture was magnificent. It really was. And it overwhelms me when I look back. How many years? 50?
Well, it's going on. It's 52 now.
52 years. The picture really stands up, and we do too.
Actually, nothing dates the picture. Perhaps an automobile, but that's about it.
It's amazing.
And now everything is retro, so what's old is new again. Everybody likes the old automobiles again.
I find you someplace, don't I?
Behind the door. Now, this is what I love.
Mm.
Would you look at that green bowl up there? That is California Fiesta ware. A little touch that we are in California. That's only made in California. And I didn't notice that until yesterday. And I said, what is that green bowl doing up there? And my son said, it's California Fiesta ware.
We never did see her again.
There's Bob Hope. God bless Paramount. They love their own. I know they had their fire controlled, but Gene, wasn't it dangerous? When you were running through all that debris and all the fire shooting up around you, did you have any problem staying on track or where they told you to walk? Because you can see how perilous it is.
Well, it's...
Ooh.
It's controlled. It's special effects. You know, they got little pockets. They cut them off quick. The flames, that is.
I think this is where you find me. And Reverend Bethany was our minister in this particular scene. That was his character's name. And there is our dear friend Nancy Hale, one of the Golden Circle girls, and the little boy who had his head in Daddy's lap. I met him years later as a grown-up. Could not believe. Well, of course, he couldn't believe he was in my dining room, but I was very shocked to meet him. Because he didn't remember much of the movie. And this was the first shot that we did, other than on location in Phoenix. Because they always shoot crowd scenes first to get rid of the extras. Now watch how this war machine crashes and that awning. A little bit later, you're going to see a reverse shot of it crashing the opposite direction identically, which, quite frankly, I never noticed until recently. So, look at all that smoke.
I think it's a film that'll live forever. I really do.
No question.
Because the subject will always be there till the end of Earth, you know.
Yes, as long as there's a communication, as long as you have some way to play this. And after DVD comes something else. This movie brought everybody together.
And we will go on.
That's just the American way. We have that spirit.
Well, it's more than the American way. I think it has to do with Earth and people.
Mm-hmm.
It's universal. But there's hope for all of us, constant, as bad as it seems to get and can get.
Hope that we can, the human race is incredible, that we can overcome anything. Last night I was at the Saturn Awards and I met James Cameron, who had done Titanic, and he's a big fan. And he said, please, there's something I've always wanted to know. When Gene Barry touches that arm when it dies, how did you make it shrivel up? And I said, well, Charlie Gamora was on the other side blowing through some tubes to make it pulse. And I said, then when it died, he sucked out all the air. And Cameron stood there and looked at me and he said, that was it? That's all? And I said, well, I'm sorry, Jim. We don't have the technology that you have today. We had to use a mayonnaise jar and a toilet bowl, you know, and to make it sound like the meteor is opening up. You know, I said, I had to laugh because he said, you got to be kidding. I said, no. I said, when your touch is dead. So he changed the light from red to green. It shrivels up in front of you because he sucks all the air out. That's our special effects, without a computer, just sheer genius.
What we see is the result. They may do it differently today, but it's there. It'll be there for them 100 years from today when people view this film. It was a great experience, and I feel proud to be part of the contribution of War of the World, the motion picture.
I'm so pleased that after all these years you have seen what a great contribution you did make to this movie and how important the movie was too. And it's changed an awful lot of people's lives. I think without this film there'd be no Spielberg, there'd be no Lucas. There wouldn't be these people. You know, even after God in his wisdom had done everything that he could do for us to kill the war machines, all we did was turn off the vacuum cleaners, and that was the sound you heard when they died. Amen. It was my pleasure to help you go through it again, frame by frame. Hopefully you found some of the comments interesting, what had happened to us during the time of the filming. It certainly was a pleasure for me to recollect this for you, and I hope you enjoy this film again for another 50 years.